Welcome to Puro Politics, the political podcast of the San Antonio Express News. My name is Gilbert Garcia, Metro columnist, and I'm joined by
business editor and columnist Greg Jefferson,
investigative reporter Brian Chasnoff,
and we hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. We're going to devote this week's podcast to kind of looking at what might happen going forward in the 2022 midterms. We're just a little bit past the midway point between the 2020 election, which put Joe Biden in office, and along with a Democratic House and Senate, and next November's midterms, which Republicans are already really optimistic about, given Biden's low poll numbers, and just the history that we have with presidents in their first term midterms. So in Texas, we got some news on Sunday that actor Matthew McConaughey is not going to run for governor. I think most of us thought that that was probably going to be the case, but he is. We know now that the governor's race is almost certainly going to be a one-on-one matchup between Republican incumbent Greg Abbott and Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke. And so, what we're going to be talking about is the midterms, the kind of the politics of the moment, and how this is going to affect Texas races, because it's. Everything that we're seeing at the national level is going to trickle down to the Texas race. So I want to start off, and you know, we've seen recent polls where you know, President Joe Biden's approval ratings are under 40%. It's been pretty consistent in recent months. The number has been pretty low for him. And Brian, I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on, like, when you look at the issues, your sense about the issues that are really driving the sort of discontent that voters have right now with Joe Biden. What stands out to you?
Well, I mean, everyone's daily lives continue to be impacted by COVID, whether that's Biden's fault or not, you know. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And then with the news about the new variant, you know, this uncertainty around that, I mean, that should be resolved for better or worse, you know, this, you know, within the next few weeks, knowing whether or not this is going to be a new crushing wave of the pandemic or just a blip. But, needless to say, that's still impacting everyone's daily life. And then, you know, just inflation is just, it's just a huge issue for the president. And, it's just the daily pressures are really hammering his administration right now.
Brian mentioned inflation, and I think that's one of the things that is, is certainly a big problem for Biden right now, and one that could, if it continues into 2022, I think is something that we would have to worry Democrats a lot. But you know, one of the things that's interesting about this is how it's getting played. You know, people in that office routinely get credited for things that they had very little to do with, and blamed for things they had very little to do with. Yeah. And so, when you come to inflation, I mean, there is an argument that Republicans are making that the cause of inflation right now is just too much money in the economy, which, you know, all this money that was pumped in by the American Rescue Plan Act earlier this year. And then, you know, the counter argument is that this is just a supply chain issue brought on by COVID. These were pre-existing conditions when Biden took office. Greg, you know, you cover business, you cover the economy. I mean, what's your sense about what the primary issue is with the inflation that we're seeing?
One of the major causes of inflation right now is the labor shortage. I mean, you've got you know, you've got a lot of employers who cannot fill open positions. So, you know, to do that, they're having to raise wages, and that just has, you know, that has a chain reaction that results in much higher inflation. There's no reason to think this is going to go away anytime soon. I mean, you know, we're still in a labor shortage. You see it every day. And that's really largely what's driving, or that's a big component of the inflation we're seeing. So, you know, that's going to linger. Nobody knows when, you know, the labor shortage is going to be over.
Is there anything that Biden could do about it? I mean, is there Is there anything that any steps that he could take? I mean, I know he's trying at this point, but
I mean, you know, sure. I mean, he can always, you know, the Federal Reserve, which, you know, oversees monetary policy for the country, it's independent of the White House, but, you know, the president can always exert, you know, influence, can lean on the Federal Reserve. But, you know, the options aren't great. I mean, they could do, you know, Gilbert, you might remember this. I do. Paul Volcker in the early 80s went to war against inflation. Basically, he did it by creating a recession. You know, and we're just coming out, you know, we're coming out of a deep economic trough brought on by the pandemic. Do we really want, you know, the Fed, you know, sending the country through shock treatment, which could result in another recession? Probably not. I think, you know, given the choice between higher prices and a recession, I think we'll take higher prices. And they're not as bad as they were in the early 80s, like the inflation numbers. And there's no reason to think they're going to get that high. But, you know, they're we're seeing inflation at a higher rate than we've seen in a very long time. And yeah, that's creating a lot of political problems for Biden.
You know, Brian, one of the things that's obvious is that in addition to the inflation problem, that Republicans are really going to emphasize culture war issues, social wedge issues in 2022, probably more than we've even seen in past elections. And we're looking at Black Lives Matter, critical race theory, political correctness, so-called cancel culture. And I wondered how effective you think this is going to be. In Texas particularly, I think this is kind of complicated because we've got a Governor Greg Abbott who's not real popular at the moment himself because of questions about how well he's dealt with our power grid problems, how well he's dealt with the pandemic. And we've got those questions coming into play in Texas politics, but we've also got Republicans really sort of hammering these culture war issues, which they really worked hard during this legislative session. How effective do you think this is going to be for them?
Well, I think Abbott is a fascinating case when it comes to this, because to me, the social issue that will loom the largest is related to the pandemic and masking versus not masking, vaccine mandates, things like that. I mean, y'all might have a different opinion about what social issues will come to the fore, and Abbott's fascinating in this because you'll recall last year he caught a lot of flack from the right on his stances, and he slowly, you know, the flack that he caught slowly, you know, corroded his position to where now I think that he's, you know, any sort of mandate related to the pandemic would be a non-starter for him. You know, do people remember how shaky that was for Abbott and how, you know, how upset it made some of those on the far right? I don't know.
Yeah. What do you think, Greg?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think we're in for another wave of coronavirus panic and the real thing. I mean, Omicron is obviously the real deal. Abbott, I think Brian's right. He's kind of stuck. Anything he does to take, you know, any kind of precautionary step he might take is going to be trouble for his base, which really wants to see very little in the way of precautions. So, you know, I think he's going to stick to it. I would have a difficult time seeing Abbott change his stripes from, you know, what we've seen over the last few months. I expect almost nothing from him in terms of, you know, mask restrictions, you know, capacity restrictions, anything like that. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. And the politics are so complicated because you'll even see some Republicans saying, well, Joe Biden didn't do a good enough job of getting the country vaccinated, and that's why we're still vulnerable, when we know he's pretty much been going to extreme lengths to try to get the numbers up for vaccinations. And in the face of at least some Republican officials sort of encouraging people to distrust the vaccine. One of the things that really that I've thought about recently is how it's early and things can change a lot from November 2021 to November 2022. But there are elements of Joe Biden's situation that remind me somewhat of Jimmy Carter, in that Jimmy Carter had some bad luck. He had Arab oil embargo that helped to drive up. Just created a real sense of frustration in the country. It drove prices up. And for most of my adult life, when new Democrats have come on the national scene, I've heard Republicans say, oh, so-and-so, I think this was done with Obama, certainly done with others, they want to send us back to the tax and spend, liberal ways of Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter was actually an austerity president. He was somebody who was obsessed with balancing the budget and was, determined to cut what he considered to be wasteful spending. And that's why he got a Democratic challenge from the left, right, from Ted Kennedy. So he was kind of held up as this is the problem with liberalism when he was really a pretty moderate figure. Joe Biden has been a pretty moderate Democrat for most of his career. And he's kind of, I think Republicans tend to not necessarily try to make him out to be some kind of radical. They tend to say that he's inept and he doesn't know what he's doing and there's been cognitive decline and that he's basically being dominated by people further left than him. But it's that same sense that there's some element of bad luck in this, that there's things that are a little bit out of his control. I mean, I don't know if you see it that way.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is with Joe Biden, it's bad luck. His timing is horrible. But when he was running for office, this was all inevitable. I mean, nobody thought was going to go away.
That's right.
I mean, we knew the pandemic was with us for a long time to come. The timing, the circumstance he finds himself in is terrible. It was totally foreseeable. I mean, this could not be a surprise to him or to, any of his supporters. And he is. I mean, he's in a really tough spot. And I think you're kind of bringing up Jimmy Carter is, I think that might be pretty apt. Although he was dealing, when he was the first post-Watergate president after Gerald Ford. And I think he had much higher hopes for his presidency. Then the oil crisis hit. Inflation took off, unemployment took off, and then you had the Iranian hostage situation. These aren't, in some ways, it's not quite as dramatic for Joe Biden, but you've got a very long, slow slog recovering from this pandemic.
For me personally, I feel like, and of course, I'm coming from a different perspective than a lot of voters in Texas, but with the previous president, it felt like we were teetering on the edge of a catastrophe every single day. Mm-hmm. With Biden, there seems to be a bit of a, promises unkept and, mm-hmm. a bit of, a sense of disappointment, but there's not this panicked feeling of,
why that is?
Constitutional crisis. Yeah.
I enjoy not feeling a sense of alarm every waking minute of my life.
Yeah, so, yeah.
What did he say today?
Exactly. It's like we don't have to doom scroll every morning to find out what crazy thing he said overnight that's going to put us all in danger.
I thought it was funny.
That's exactly right. I was just going to say, and I don't know how, I mean, for me, that's very motivating, that distinction that, I don't know if other people have the same feeling that would perhaps, not allow the Republicans to sweep Democrats quite as horribly mm-hmm. next year, but we'll mm-hmm. see.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. You all were talking about tweets, and I think it was a few months ago. U.S. Senator John Cornyn from Texas was criticizing Biden, And I think one of the things that he said was, you know, the tweets he sends out are just kind of like official kind of White House statements, almost, you know, just kind of like press release kind of statements. And it was, you know, this was meant as a bad thing. And I think a lot of people responded, at least at that time, you know, saying, well, it's not so bad to have a president who is not just like going on some like personal like attack against somebody that they don't like, you know, that he's just actually just telling you what the White House is doing that day.
I mean,
you know, that's
right. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely. Like, I mean, it was a daily dose of just toxicity from Trump. And well, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Cornyn's tweet was really interesting to me. Like at the time, when I first saw it, I almost thought it was a joke, like he was being ironic. Because, you know, I think John Cornyn is a very sharp, highly intelligent guy. And I think he's, you know, he is a capable politician. And I guess I just couldn't accept that, like, his idea of leadership has been so degraded under Trump and Trumpism that now suddenly he thinks it's unpresidential to not, you know, anger tweet every morning. I mean, to me, that was just remarkable. So Senator Cornyn, you seriously think that, you know, outrageous tweets is now part of the job of president. And if you don't do it, you're not actually doing your job. I mean, to me, that was just incredible.
It was, and I think that it was coming from this place that the Republicans were saying it. I think, you know, that Biden has not been out and about, and, you know, that we don't see him as often as we've maybe seen other recent presidents. Some kind of perception that's maybe being pushed by Republicans that Biden is maybe being hidden in some way because he's not really up to he's not up to a lot of questions, and he's not up to a lot of interaction with the media. But I think focusing on tweeting just seemed to be that was kind of an odd way of coming at that argument.
I mean, honestly, you can kind of understand it because under Trump, you know, he did make so many policy pronouncements by Twitter, and you know, he in the ugliest possible way, he would hire and fire on Twitter. I mean, it was his megaphone. So, I mean, I guess I can see where they're coming from in that regard. Like he abused Twitter and pretended to govern that way. Mm-hmm. So maybe they just got used to it.
One of the things I was thinking about is, you know, the pattern of presidents in their first term facing having their parties face tough midterms. I mean, you know, obviously it had a lot to do with the specific circumstances. But if you go back at least to like Lyndon Johnson, 1966, he was starting to deal with some disenchantment with the Vietnam War and so on. But pretty much every president we've seen since then, I think the big exception was George W. Bush, who was very popular at the time of the first midterms in 2002 because of a lot of goodwill that came to him off of the 9/11 attacks. But generally speaking, going back decades, this is what happens to presidents, and what happens to their party. And one of the things I was thinking about related to San Antonio is that we've got an open seat for county judge in 2022. We already have some sense of who might be running. We had Ina Minhadas on the podcast last week, a state representative. She's running. Former Judge Peter Sakai is running. Former Mayor Ed Garza thought about running. Evelise Mesa Gonzalez from Ron Nuremberg's chief of staff has said that she's thinking about running. These are all Democratic candidates, and I guess the question I would ask you this, Greg, is there any opening there for a Republican? I mean, the most competitive race that I can remember the county judge race was in 2014 when we had former city councilman Carlton Soles running as a Republican, challenging Nelson Wolf, and he got within about 8%. That was a really good Republican wave year. And even with that Republican wave behind him, he got it was a competitive race, but he couldn't get closer than about 8%. Is there any opening that you could see given what we might be seeing?
It would be tough. I don't think so, honestly. I think, I would love to see Lyle Larson get into the race. I think he would bring a really, given his rebellion against the Republican Party and the fact that he doesn't embrace the Democratic Party agenda. I mean, he does seem to be his own person. I think he could really inject some really interesting ideas into a county judge's race in Bexar County. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. And even at that, I just think that he would just on a partisan basis have a really difficult time. I mean, the last Republican county judge we had was Cindy Taylor Cryer, and she, a lot of her appeal was, it was kind of based in her person. I mean, you didn't look at her and think Republican. You just thought Cindy Taylor Cryer, former state senator, fairly moderate, very personable, and she had a big vision, I think, for the county. I mean, we forget that, she when the Spurs were, talking about a new arena, she's really the one who, the AT&T Center is where it is, and it is what it is because of her. She brought the public along for good or ill. I mean, there are, that was probably one of the biggest capital projects under her. There's a lot to criticize there, but she brought the public along. They supported, the election that brought it, the financing about. But I think that time has passed. I think any Republican candidate is just going to have a really difficult time in Bexar County. Especially, with as polarized as our politics are these days. Yeah.
Well, we're about 2 weeks away from the filing deadline for the 2022 primaries, and so we're going to know a lot more, as we come back for our next podcast.
Do we know why McConaughey bailed?
It was a very, I thought it was a pretty long, I guess it was about 3 minutes, but it felt really long. His explanation.
It was like his Oscar.
Yeah. It was pretty much like that. It was it was basically talking about leadership and people stepping forward, but then he was using that as a preface to announcing that he wasn't going to step forward. And I think he said that he's going to focus on trying to help entrepreneurs and people who can create jobs and do things in Texas. So it was that sort of thing. But the funny thing is, he was saying that I've learned a lot about Texas politics along the way. And there have been some indications in recent interviews that he didn't even have the most rudimentary understanding of how Texas government works. And I think that had been exposed a little bit in recent interviews and would have been more exposed pretty quickly once he got in the race. So I always kind of felt that this, when he first started talking about this, this was shortly after he had published a memoir, or I think it's an autobiography or memoir, whatever it was. And it felt to me like this was kind of a book promotional gimmick. And I still kind of think that's what was happening. I don't know.
Maybe he just got away from him.
But the weird thing is that in recent polls, you saw, him, he would be, Abbott was 37%, McConaughey 27%. I think this was the Dallas Morning News recent poll. McConaughey 27, Beth O'Rourke 26. So this was, it may have not stayed that way. It probably wouldn't have, but we were looking at the possibility of a real 3-person race if he had done this. And I just don't see how that would have been. No matter what side of the fence you're on, I don't see how this would have been a positive thing for Texas to have somebody who's just kind of on an ego trip and sort of just kind of just muddying up the race, as far as I can tell. I don't know. What do y'all think?
I'm sure Beto is glad. I mean, I still think that McConaughey's candidacy would have hurt him, O'Rourke more than Greg Abbott.
Sure.
So I'm sure he's relieved. To me, it was kind of, you're right. Like he was polling okay. But you know, the first time he makes a verbal gaffe or mm-hmm. exposes how very little he knows about, you know, Texas state government, mm-hmm. like it would have cratered. But even at that, you know, it would have done damage to Beto O'Rourke's campaign, I would think, more so than Abbott's.
Yeah. It, you know, it's somewhat similar maybe to Ross Perot in 1992. I mean, people always forget that Ross Perot was, he was running first in a 3-person race against George H.W. Bush mm-hmm. and Bill Clinton. And I mean, he was looking like he was in a fantastic position, and the numbers started following the more he talked. And eventually, you know, he dropped out, he got back in, and he still did, you know, remarkably well, all things considered. But,
well, you know, but I mean, at least, you know, at least Ross Perot had something he was running on, right?
That's
like
true.
He was the anti-NAFTA candidate. He yeah. was all about, you know, a very old fashioned idea of how trade policy should work, but still, and he you know, he was relentless on that. Like
he was,
what did McConaughey want to do? You know, it's like,
we still that is a great question.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it was a very different, you're right. I mean, there are similarities with Ross Perot, but at least with Perot, you know, he had something. He had
there was substance. Yeah.
It was
yeah.
kind of, it was Gramps. It was basically Grandpa's agenda.
That's right.
And Grandpa's cranky and he took my airtime. And I couldn't imagine McConaughey doing that, you know.
Well, since I'd like to think we're the only podcast recently that has mentioned Ross Perot and Matthew McConaughey in the same sentence. So I'm proud of that. And on that note, we're going to wrap things up. Hope everyone's doing well. And we'll be back next week. Take care.